Okay, welcome back. At this time, we're going to look to Brother Lorne to give us a short update on the Christian School Resource Committee. After that, Brother Noah has asked for a chance to read a short story that he would like to add to his morning talk on empowering the educator to engage the learner. He did not have time for that this morning, so we will squeeze that in right after Lorne's update on the Christian School Resource Committee. Brother Lorne.
Well, it was a good day again so far, I think. Wish to thank each one for coming, especially the Fairhaven congregation for hosting. We really appreciate that as a committee when we can ask someone else to come along and help plan, because if we plan our own ideas, our own circle, we get trapped in our own groove, I guess, and so that's a special blessing. Along with that, you've seen Leon Bowman here moderating. He's our newest member addition, and again, a strong plus, because the committee has been going for 8 years, and about half of us have been there for the full duration, so to get someone younger, new blood, new ideas, and especially enthusiasm, it's been a real blessing. And Eli moderated this morning. We're also thankful for him. He was on the committee in various roles and then left, but he's when he became ordained bishop, but he still comes back whenever we can, and we welcomed him with open arms, especially today, as Philip Hurst was not able to be here in the last minute. And Alvin Burkhardt, I don't know if you met him, he's still our behind the scenes. He's the one that keeps the emails going out, broadcast, and to let people know, and to try keep the tech side together. We're still thankful we can call him or text him for whatever we need from time to time. And thanks for sharing in the offering. It was just over $3,000 was lifted here in the auditorium. And I know there's others of you who have paid before, and we appreciate that, to have some money in the account when we start in on a project. Other question was, were your teachers at the Teacher Inspiration Day at Bethel in February? I would say about half the schools have paid and half have not. And so we're not pointing fingers. We're not going to chase after anybody. But if you know you had teachers there, could just check with your secretary or your treasurer, see if they paid or not. Then we have the evaluation forms. Please do fill them out and put some thought into it. You think it's extra work, but it does give input when we're going around the circle again. How soon do we bring a subject back that was had before? And we value your input and planning. Well, being we have this story yet, we will cut this short. I wasn't planning to talk here, and we'll listen to Noah's story.
The story will speak for itself, but it captures what we as administrators empowering our educators, our goal is that our children can learn to read and write. My Father's Hands by Calvin R. Worthington. His hands were rough and exceedingly strong. He could gently prune a fruit tree or firmly wrestle an ornery mule into harness. He could draw and saw a square with quick accuracy. He had been known to peel his knuckles upside a tough jaw, but what I remember most is the special warmth from those hands soaking through my shirt as he would take me by the shoulder and, hunkering down beside my ear, point out the glittering swoop of a blue hawk or a rabbit asleep in its lair. They were good hands that served him well and failed him in only one thing. They never learned to write. My father was illiterate. The number of illiterates in our country has steadily declined, but if there were only one left, I would be saddened, remembering my father and the pain he endured because his hands had never learned to write. He started in the first grade, where the remedy for a wrong answer was 10 ruler strokes across a stretched out palm. For some reason, shapes, figures, and recitations just didn't fall into the right pattern inside his 6-year-old toe head. Maybe he suffered from some type of learning handicap, such as dyslexia. His father took him out of school after several months and set him to a man's job on the farm. Years later, his wife, with her fourth grade education, would try to teach him to read, and still later, I would grasp his big fist between my small hands and awkwardly help him trace the letters of his name. He submitted to the ordeal, but soon grew restless. Flexing his fingers and kneading his palms, he would declare that he had had enough and depart for a long solitary walk. Finally, one night, when he thought no one saw, he slipped away with my second grade reader and labored over the words until they became too difficult. And then he pressed his forehead into the pages and wept. Oh, not even a child's book. Thereafter, no amount of persuading could bring him to sit with pen or paper or book. From the farm to road building, and later to factory work, his hands served him well. His mind was keen, his will to work unsurpassed. During World War II, he was a pipe fitter in a shipyard and installed the complicated guts of the mighty fighting ships. His enthusiasm and efficiency brought an offer to become the line boss until he was handed a qualification test. His fingers could trace a path across the blueprints while his mind imagined the pipes lacing through the heart of the ship. He could recall every twist and turn of the pipes, but he couldn't read or write. After the shipyard closed, he went to the cotton mill, where he labored at night and stole from his sleeping hours the time required to run our farm. When the mill shut down, he went out each morning looking for work, only to return night after night and say to mother as she fixed his dinner, "They just don't want anybody who can't take a test." It had always been hard for him to stand before a man and make an X mark for his name, but the hardest moment came when he placed his mark, his X, by the name someone else had written for him, and saw another man walk away with the deed to our beloved farm. When it was over, he stood before the window and slowly turned the pen he still held in his hands, gazing unseeing down the mountainside. I went to the spring house and wept. Eventually, he found another cotton mill job, and we moved into a mill house village with 100 look-alike houses. He never quite adjusted to town life. The blue of his eyes faded, skin across his cheekbones became a little slack, but his hands kept their strength and their warmth still soaked through when he would sit me on his lap and ask that I read to him from the Bible. He took great pride in my reading and would listen for hours as I struggled through the awkward phrases. Once, when Mother left for a weekend to visit her sister, Dad went to the store and returned with some food for our dinner while I was busy building my latest homemade wagon. After the meal, he said he had a surprise for dessert and went out to the kitchen where I could hear him opening the can, and then everything went quiet. I went to the doorway and saw him standing before the sink with the open can in his hand. "The picture looked like pears," he mumbled. He walked out and sat on the back steps, and I knew he had been embarrassed before his own son, for the can read, "Whole white potatoes," but the picture on the label did look, indeed, a great deal like pears. I went and sat beside him and asked if he would point out to me the stars. He knew where the Big Dipper and all the other stars were located, and we talked about how they got there in the first place. He kept that can on a shelf in our woodshed for a long while, and a few times I saw him turning it round and round in his hands as if the touch of the words might somehow teach him to write. Years later, when Mom died, I tried to get him to come live with my family, but he insisted on staying in his small frame house on the edge of town with a few farm animals and a garden plot. His health was failing him, and he was in and out of the hospital several times with mild heart attacks. Old Doc Green saw him weekly and gave him medication, including nitroglycerine tablets, to put under his tongue should he feel an attack coming on. My last fond memory of Dad was watching as he walked across the brow of a hillside meadow with those big, warm hands, now gnarled with age, resting on the shoulders of our two children. He stopped to point out, confidentially, a pond where he and I had swum and fished years before. That night, my family and I flew to a new job and a new home overseas. 3 weeks later, he was gone of a heart attack. I returned home alone for the funeral. Doc Green told me how sorry he was. In fact, he was bothered because he had just written Dad a new nitroglycerine prescription and the druggist had filled it, yet the bottle of pills had not been found on Dad's person. Doc Green felt that a pill might have kept him alive long enough to summon help. An hour before the chapel service, I found myself standing near the edge of Dad's garden where a neighbor had found him. In grief, I stopped to trace my fingers in the earth where a great man had reached the end of his life. And then my hand came to rest on a half-buried brick, which I aimlessly lifted and tossed aside before I noticed underneath it the twisted and battered, yet unbroken, soft plastic bottle that had been beaten into the soft earth. As I held the bottle of nitroglycerine pills, the scene of Dad struggling to remove the cap and in desperation trying to break the bottle with the brick flashed painfully before my eyes. With deep anguish, I knew now why those big warm hands had lost in their struggle with death. For there, imprinted on the bottle cap, were the words, "Childproof cap, push down and twist to unlock." And the druggist later confirmed that he had just started using the new safety bottle. I knew it was not a purely rational act, but I went right downtown and bought a leather-bound dictionary and a golden pen set and placed them in Dad's big old hands that had failed him in the end.